Okay, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
What the so funny about me? Tell me what's funny.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
Now, my shit together is my shit together.
Nice personality combination, hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Well, and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tamar Rickey on the board. S&P futures up 4, NASDAQ futures up 134. We're going to the moon here. It looks like we've got maybe a, I don't know, maybe we're going to new heights. Maybe it's a blow-off top. Who knows? Stay tuned, I guess, in the market. It seems like if you read the tea leaves from Washington and how things seem to get played out, I'm guessing that people think the labor numbers today are going to be crummy enough to have the Fed not raise rates, which Vice President J.D. Vance was talking about yesterday. They need a little help from the Fed. They need to lower rates, not raise them. And I think if they pour more money into the system, we're going to continue to see the market go up. I suspect we're going to see that all the way to the election, and who knows, maybe after. And, well, that's just, you know, just a read. What could be wrong. The numbers could come out today the other way. That's what makes it a fun market, I guess. Do we have Professor Kevin?
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm recovering.
Recovering good?
Yeah, it's positive. I probably bit off a little more than I could chew yesterday. In other words, I was out of Cleveland at 7 a.m. after surgery the afternoon before. And that was so I could teach my class at 1 o'clock. So, you know, by the time I got to that, I was ready to keel over.
If you have any kind of anesthesia, you got to give yourself a few days at any age, even yours.
Even my advanced age.
Anyway, all's well that ends well. You'll be good by Monday. You'll be bouncing around.
Probably.
At the
such that I've ever bounced around any time in the last 15 years.
I remember I had a talk about a fight with another Irish guy, two Irish guys. I had a, I don't know, what do you want to call it, a discoloration of skin on my earlobe. So I go in and the guy takes it off and he says, well, you got a very slight stage one melanoma in the middle. It doesn't look like it's on the edges, but oh, by the way, we have to go around the edges to make sure. And I go, all right. He said, well, there's a problem with that. I go, okay. I took all the skin that I could to stretch and cover it. There's no more skin there. So when you take some more off, you're going to have to do a skin graft, which means you got to go to a, whatever you want to call it, some kind of a plastic surgeon. And I go, really? Yeah. So there I go. And I say to the guy, I don't want a general. Yeah, well, we want to do a general. Well, I don't want a general for my ear. You can do a local. Finally, he agrees with me, right? And so I show up, and the first person I meet is this sweet young lady, and I go, by the way, who are you? Well, I'm your anesthesiologist. And I go, you're not supposed to be here. What do you mean? Anyway, so the doctor comes in. Well, I decided we needed to go to general. You want to go home, or you want me to do it? And I'm thinking, should I punch this guy, or should I let him do it? Well, I let him do it. And so the next day, you know, I was supposedly okay. Audrey takes me. I wanted to go to this old car thing on Route 66. Mm-hmm. It's got to be like 95, Kevin. I'm walking along. And this is 20-some years ago. I was young. I'm walking along, and I go, you know, I don't feel so hot. You're sweating away. And she goes, you shouldn't be out here a day after anesthesia. What's the matter with you? Well, made it back to the car, got home with the air conditioner. I was okay, but it takes a bit. You think it doesn't, but it's probably a week before that's out of you. Even if it's a little bit. And they don't tell you this.
They say.
Dr. J's dad, one of the nicest men I ever met, was the transplant surgeon. It was on Time and Newsweek for transplanting livers and small kids and stuff. Hey, buddy, I'm never going to kill you. The anesthesiologist will. Thanks, Doc. There you go.
Well, they all visited. So
there you go. So, anywho, we got the labor numbers coming out today. We're looking for, they are looking for 50,000 positive. Last month was horrible. It was not only negative, but they pulled down the 3 months before by a total of 100,000. So, actually, it was like 130,000 negative. So this month we'll see. Hopefully better in all areas, but you know maybe not. We'll see on that. What are you seeing on your end, Kevin? People hiring, firing here on this end. It's weird. I've heard from John Lee, who's on the show on Monday, that his I guess he's going to be his daughter-in-law. He's graduated some super duper degree in.
Hold the plan anyway, is what you're saying.
Yeah, you know, she's having trouble finding a job. And she's got, you know, some advanced, God knows what degree. And it's not as smooth as it was a few years ago, I don't think. But I don't know if it's horrible, is it?
I don't think it is. I think people who want to get jobs can get jobs. It's going to vary from one area to the next, one field of expertise to the next. But, yeah, I think people pretty much who are looking can find stuff.
What do you think of 2 weeks ago, wasn't this week, Eric was talking about the and I always put the people that you're teaching in a specialized, almost special category. They kind of know what they want. Matter of fact, your name was brought up huge last Saturday at dinner. I don't know if you know this or not. Aud and I went to this Thai restaurant, and the people are terrific. It's family owned, and there's been a young lady who's kind of waited on us for a long time, and she's terrific. I knew she was going to school. I had no idea what she was doing. So this last Saturday, another girl comes in, and she knew us. She'd waited on us a few times. And she goes, yeah, well, I forgot the other girl's name. She went off to Purdue. I said, really? And I go, what's the deal with that? And she goes, well, she was in Moraine Valley for 2 years, basically kicked ass. And now she's going to Purdue for biophysics, of all things, which I don't even know what the hell that is. I go, you got to be kidding me. Good for her. And I think, wow, that's what Kevin's doing to people. Now, if she goes there for 2 years, however much that costs, it's not 4 years. And maybe she even got partial ride if she's that good. I had no idea Moraine Valley had something in biophysics, for God's sake. And I mean, I think that's great, don't you? I mean, I'm sitting there, boy, that's what Kevin does all day. No wonder he likes it. Well, I wouldn't accuse you of being a biophysicist by any stretch.
Different. And I get a different batch of students. So, yes, I get students who want to move on. In fact, I was just talking to one who wanted to go get a degree in cybersecurity at Purdue. But I also get students who just are there for specific credentials that they can add to their resumes.
Well, but you guys have like a full business stuff and everything, and you have other engineering stuff that you're not directly teaching, I guess what I'm saying, correct?
Yeah, we have engineering program, and I don't teach it.
How come? How come you're not out teaching civil engineering?
I would, but I only have so much bandwidth. You know, I have expertise in every damn thing.
Would I drive over a bridge that the people learn from Kevin how this bridge is supposed to work? Yeah, I would. You know, you would make a crummy old bridge.
I wouldn't.
One
thing, I just want to comment on your conversation with Lou yesterday. When he threw out an interesting idea that the colleges can act in loco parentis and that changes the nature of the relationship with employees. And that's an interesting thought. Don't know if I agree with it or not. But those parents, so to speak, are sure giving their kids a hell of an allowance.
Yeah. I don't know if you were... Well, you weren't driving in. You're at home. Evidently, there's a stay. Not a stay. There's a judge ruling as of, like, this morning that those two kids can play for LSU. Two guys that came back from the pros. One guy evidently is not in game shape, so he won't play, but the other guy will. Is that tonight or tomorrow?
They're playing this weekend. That's all I know.
And yesterday I was, you know, I click on whatever I get from Interactive Brokers or news feed. It's a very liberal news feed. It's almost as bad to look at as the other side. But all kinds of big headlines about crazy people doing stuff, and then when you read through it, anyway, that's another. But one of them was the I don't know who he was, Kevin. He was was he the commissioner of the SEC or, you know, some jamoke. And he's, you know, pontificating that we'll fight to the death for this rule. Basically, he didn't say it in those words, but, you know we're going to go down for this rule. The pros can't come back here. And Kevin, you know, I don't understand. Yeah, it's people have a way of aggrandizing what they do. You know, when I look at my business and the markets are not as good as they used to be, and I'm doing a lot of individual stocks for people, and some of them aren't all that liquid, but, you know, my job is to protect it for people if that's what they want me to do. So if a spread is two bid at four, and I go in to pay three because I think that's the fair price, I guess I could say I'm just a philanthropist giving somebody else, I'm a liquidity provider, giving somebody else to sell me something at three when they otherwise could do it at two. Or I could just say what I am. I'm doing the best for my client. I really don't give a rat's ass about the other guy. I hope he doesn't lose too much, but I hope I win. And sometimes he does, sometimes I do. But the fact is, I don't put some halo around my head that doesn't belong there. I mean, I'm just doing the best I can for my person and getting something the cheapest I possibly can. That's what I do, okay? And that's what people pay me to do. And I'm okay with it. I'm just, sometimes the other side wins and sometimes I do. But for these guys to somehow act like this guy, wherever he is, I don't know what his salary is, but I'm sure it's not 48 cents an hour. He is full bore in pro mode. He's probably making as much as the general manager of the Bears, for God's sake. Or one of the big shots at the NFL. I mean, for them guys to turn around and say, well, I can be a pro, but you guys can't be. I mean, where do these people come from? I just don't get. Admit what you are. You're a gangster.
It's a matter of great degree nowadays, Tom, because once upon a time, it was more egregious because I can be a pro and you can't even accept small amounts of money.
Well,
This has ever been true. It's always been the fatal flaw of the what I will call the college sports employment model. This idea that it's an extracurricular activity, and they're student athletes. I mean, yes, in many cases, probably in a whole lot of cases, they are really excellent students, and they're dedicated, and they get some educational value out of what they do, but. But nevertheless, this is not an extracurricular activity for them. They spend not as much time as the NFL guys because there's some limitations around that. But at their age, they shouldn't be spending that kind of time anyway.
All right, but what you're I think your comment is correct, but it's somewhere down the slippery slope. I mean, I'm gonna back up more years than you just did. I don't think, certainly when you walk into the bar in Michigan City and they got all the things on the wall when the Irish played eight or nine games and no bowl games and the coach made $15,000 a year, I think everybody, and what were the assistant coaches made all the rice they could eat, I think everybody was sort of in the amateur mode, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
So, and somewhere along the line, I'm going to say even when we were in school.
But the rules were pretty harsh about that.
Yeah.
So, yes, they were, but at the same time, the NCAA was pretty draconian about enforcing that.
Well, I'm just looking at it from the money side. I mean, you could only be on, with Wide World of Sports even on back then? Maybe not. I mean, you only could be on national TV twice a year, and most schools weren't even that. Most schools weren't at all. And then all of a sudden now in our era, the era of ERA, I'm going to say that ERA made $60,000 a year. What do you think Tom Pagna made? 35, 40? Somewhere in there, there wasn't this flat. It wasn't even a shoe contract at that point. But maybe our senior year to begin to get a shoe contract. All of a sudden, everybody was in an amateur mode. Who was the guy who was the athletic director? He didn't make $2 million a year. What did he make? What are we talking about? The guy was a double All-American. God, I know
Moose
the guy.
Krause.
Bruce Krause. What do you think Moose made? 70, maybe? 65?
I don't know. Notre Dame, once upon a time, had a rule that the coach, and therefore I assume AD and others, could not be paid more than the highest paid professor at the school.
Yeah. So, I mean, so we were I'm not saying that, you know, as Eric mentioned,
they
that
include outside income, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, Eric isn't right that if somebody had to get a Greyhound bus ticket to go to his uncle's funeral, somebody didn't feed him $20 under the table. I'm guessing that happened, but at the same time, I think what I'm trying to say here, clumsily, Kevin, is all these other people are already well into the pro mode and getting paid like that, being the national TV contracts, all the other stuff, and they're just reluctant to let the players get in the same league, right? I mean, they're there.
Hypocrisy all along, and we've talked about it here.
But, I mean, it's different from era's era. I guess you could say it wasn't, you know, totally amateur. But, like I said, the guy sat next to me in class. I mean, but now does anybody... But you lose power. Do you honestly think, I mean, and you teach classes in this, Under Armour, and this is the last one I really know some of the details on, Under Armour paid Hardman, what, $1 million? Do you really think that the Irish were in any position to say, oh, we found out that on his Zoom graduate class, some other guy sat there and said it was him, we're suspending him for 2 weeks? That would have gone on like a fart in the boardroom of Under Armour.
Yeah, but that's a hypothetical scenario. We don't know that happened. We don't even know.
No. What I'm saying, they would lose the power to do that. How could they? You think Under Armour cares if that kid goes to class?
They don't care, but the school, each individual school has to determine what its standards are and how much reputational damage they're willing to risk. And so some schools are willing to take a lot more risk than others.
Well,
I don't know in that scenario. I don't know, and I don't know if it would have been any different had he stayed at Wake Forest, had he gone to Stanford, had he gone to Indiana. I don't know what the difference would have been. It's possible that every one of the schools I just mentioned would have, would require that you pursue your class seriously.
Well,
I don't know that one way or the other. I do know of quite a few athletes who have spoken about what their academic curriculum is here in South Bend, and they pretty much have to, have to adhere. They spend a lot of time lightening their load during the season by taking summer courses, but actually the number of athletes who graduate after 3 years is pretty amazing.
I'm not saying at all that some schools, and I really hope and believe that the Irish are one of them. On the undergrad part, is anybody even still trying to keep track of people making progress? But on the grad level, you were the guy that said, "Boy, how do you ever track that down?"
I don't know. You do have to file. You still have to file the academic progress report to the NCAA, and if you are not making sufficient progress, you can be locked out of bowl games or postseason of any kind. So there's at least a token level of compliance that has to happen. Well, and so now if we turn to the LSU situation, do they have to do the same thing? How hard do they work at it? I don't know. I don't know anything about LSU. I don't know anything about LSU academically, other than I do know somebody who went to med school there, and he was a very, very serious student. And in his pre-med program at Notre Dame, he was, if he wasn't 4.0, he was damn close to it. So I'm not about to say the school's a joke, but I have no idea how they handle the academics.
Well, that kind of brings up another question.
By the way, don't let me get away from LSU without talking about Kate Cavall.
Yeah, that kind of brings up another question, Kevin. We, to a certain extent, even me, we're kind of sports junkies. And I don't know who was on the show the one day. I don't think it was you. We're talking about people going, all these teams, UCLA and those teams going to the Big Ten, and how kind of ridiculous it was for the swimming team to fly to New Jersey and what the hell they're doing. We make it sound like this is, well, actually it's probably getting to be really big money, but make it sound like it's, that's the school. I mean, it doesn't surprise me that LSU has a very serious medical school, because that's kind of what they do. I mean, Indiana, the year before they became a good football team, and I argue with Lou about this all the time, had their biggest year ever in getting outside money for like the med school and the business school and stuff, those people didn't care if they had a football team. Now, granted, if your football team does well, you're going to sell more jerseys and all that kind of crap. But if you look at the top end of this, and the last time I checked, the UCLA's budget is like $11.1 billion. And to think that to make another $20 million on the football team, you're going to occupy the board of directors for 3 weeks, I don't see it, Kevin. Illinois and Wisconsin, their budgets all in are like $7.8 billion. And, you know, I guess it's nice if the football team makes another $10 million, but really? I mean, what you just said, I think, is absolutely true. LSU is, without the football team, and, you know, except for the people that, you know, live and die by the damn thing, would go on fine without the football team, I think. I mean, but
you guys were talking about networks the other day too. So, you know, what's your LSU degree, your LSU business degree, as an example? It's a network. Some schools have national networks, so you can connect with alumni, and it's good for career building. I am sure I have no doubt LSU has a really good business program, and their people are but the network is more regional. Louisiana, maybe the states surrounding Louisiana, are pretty good for the network, but it's not a complete national network. So you have, you have a lot that goes on around the school. And again, the question, which I said earlier, is, you know, is what's going on with the athletic department and the rest of the school? Do they run amok, or, you know, do they get a free pass on everything and that's just the exception? Or is the school very, very concerned about its academic reputation enough so that it's going to require the students to take it seriously? That's going to vary from school to school.
So what is the dynamic?
I did an investigation. I put together a number of schools and what majors the athletes were taking. And I think that was in the days of Urban Meyer at Florida. And there were over 50% of the people were in a sociology program, the same, a very specific sociology program. And this was all of their athletes. Do you think that there was some kind of relationship between the athletic department, the football coaching staff, and the sociology department?
Yeah,
a little.
Well, everybody...
because the norm... When I looked at it, the norm for most schools was that the athletes would take things that would lead to careers after athletics was over, whether that was after the NFL or whether that was after the senior year, and that could be things like media, that could be anything that had to do with coaching. So you might Department of Education. Getting your secondary ed credentials. It's those kinds of things, and that's what you would expect to be normal. And then you're going to have some who major in everything else. You get your business, you will get your social, you will get, you know, people of varied interests. But if I were expecting a concentration amongst the athletes, that's what I would expect. It is for them to be able to
continue
an athletics related career, even if you're not competing.
What was the one that got the North Carolina in all the trouble? Who's the guy who was on the Bears, the defensive end?
Oh yeah, Julius Peppers among them.
Was it Black Studies or something?
Program. It wasn't just Peppers, but he was part of it.
Was it Black Studies or something?
That was Black Studies program.
In our day, I mean, all the athletes found their way through Coach Leahy in the economics department. And they called him Coach because all the athletes took it, but I took it for two classes. He was good. It wasn't the hardest course I ever took, but it surely wasn't the easiest either.
Well, we all know who the easier professors are, and we took their classes. So,
well, plus the athletes always got an advantage. They could pick their classes first because they went to practice at 3 o'clock. You know, so in theory, it was to make sure that your classes didn't conflict with your schedule. But they got to take the ones that. But I mean, I tell you what, I took labor economics from Coach Leahy, and I remember most of it. I thought it was real good.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't like calculus economics, but it was good. Anyway,
just real quickly before you get off of LSU, Does the name Kate Cavall mean anything to you?
That's not the guy who's the coach, is it? No.
No, he's a she.
He's a she. No, actually, no.
Kate, like in Catherine. Okay. Kate Cavall played as a freshman at Notre Dame and then transferred to LSU. She's from Ukraine, and her brother was in grad school at LSU.
We're talking basketball?
Yeah, she's basketball. Right. So 6'5" center. And so she went and played at LSU last year. And her brother was there as a grad student, and their father is in the army in Ukraine, and you know, and most of her family is still there. So, you know, she's very heightened awareness of everything that's going on in that country, everything that's going on with all the battles and so on. 2 days after the ability to put your name in the portal closed, the head coach there, Kim Mulkey, recruited and signed a Russian player, which kind of a problem for Cavall.
You got to be kidding me.
I am not kidding you. So Cavall has decided, and she explained this all in her public posting about it. She explained it. She is leaving the program. She can't transfer right away. She might be able to, you know, do an appeal and get herself placed. But she's at the point now where the rules say she has to sit out a year, and she's saying, I don't care. I'm not playing with a Russian.
Well, the Irish would like her back. I'd like her back.
Well, I'm sure. I don't know if that'll happen or not, but I'd love to see it. She was a good ball player.
But she's got some spunk, too. I mean, she sounds like a good girl. I'd want her for that.
She is. So, you know, kind of an interesting development there. And, geez, Kim Mulkey, what in the hell are you thinking?
I'm not a fan. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. Well, she does embrace the whole trashy look. So I got to give her credit. You know, it's one thing to...
When Larissa pops in, let me know, will you?
One thing to come off with that trashy attire, but to take it to the nth degree is just, I say, okay, if you're going to do it right. Over at North Carolina in football, there's an investigation.
Hey, but before you go, about this kid being able to play tonight by the judge.
Yeah.
So you've been the starting tackle all week. What happens tomorrow night? They say move over or what? The guy didn't practice with anybody, or did he?
Not likely to start, Tom. I don't think you have to worry about that. Not tonight. Might take the job next week or 2 weeks from now.
Well, if he was a wide receiver or something, he could start. I mean, I'm sure you could figure that out.
They usually don't do a lot of rotating offensive linemen, but or defensive linemen rotate a lot. So, yeah, there's a way to put the guy into rotation. Special circumstances, say he's a good pass rusher, you put him in third and long all the time. You know, there's a lot you can do there to use the guy.
I have no idea what the guy does or what position, how good he is, do you?
No, don't know anything about him.
I'm sure we'll... Since it just happened this morning, it's not like we're that far behind the news. But the judge is having a pretty good fight with the SEC, isn't he?
It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. And I'm just going to sit back and watch. I don't have an opinion on it.
If you see Larissa pop in, let me know.
She's here.
You are? Hey, how are you?
Good morning. Good morning. How is everybody?
We're doing okay for considering.
Larissa, let's do one more college thing. So at North Carolina in the football program, first of all, the general manager for the football program, Michael Lombardi, resigned after spending more than a month on paid administrative leave. Well, there's an investigation over personnel complaints. So what we see is defensive coordinator Steve Belichick, the coach's son, used drugs on the job, this is the allegation, used drugs on the job and provided drugs to at least one North Carolina player. A member of UNC's recruiting staff had a sexual relationship with a player. Assistant coaches may have had sexual relationships with members of the recruiting staff. And Steve Belichick, the coach's son, has been on an undisclosed medical leave since August 6th. So I am pretty sure that when Bill Belichick took the job, he was going to, one, prove that he could win in college. That was probably the first thing he wanted to do. But he also wanted to put his son in a position to take over for him. I'm thinking that's not going to happen now.
Probably not.
These people seem to have a lot of time to get in a lot of trouble, don't they?
I don't know. Sometimes it doesn't take that long.
Let's leave that one alone.
It should, but that doesn't mean it does.
So is this a guy having relations with a lady basketball player or a lady something-something having a relationship with a football player?
I don't have details, Tom. That's just what I got out of the news report.
Oh, God. Anyway.
Yeah, fun stuff. Welcome to college football.
Yeah, welcome to the world. Unreal.
I was switch over to something that will drag Larissa into the conversation.
Well, she's my it's funny, Larissa. I was thinking on the way in this morning that you were going to be on, and I said, you know, there we can have somebody who's a professor or something talk about big economic numbers, and then once in a while I'll listen to Joan Esposito's show and she'll have somebody call in, you know, essentially her listeners are not quite the same as ours, and some lady will call in and she'll rant and rave about the price of God knows what being up 40 cents, which, you know, by the way, nothing wrong with that. And I said, I know the only person that can put those two together and make sense. Take what's going on in the grocery store, God help you if you have to put an air conditioner in or a new roof on, and tie it together with these huge numbers that everybody's gleeful of about how much people are spending. And every time I hear something like that, I think, that's where Larissa comes in, because these numbers are just, I don't know what they are, Larissa. I mean, the unemployment rate, I heard one of the guys in the administration was Besson crowing about the unemployment rate. Well, okay, but we've got more people that could be working that aren't than ever, and our employment ratio is sinking every month. Even though somehow these guys get the unemployment rate down, what do you make of all? I mean, what are you seeing as health here? How do you, if you had to put some statistics together and give a presentation to the world on TV, where would you put our health? Where would you even, how would you handicap the major numbers? I mean, the labor numbers are coming out today. Whatever they are, where do you put them?
Well, I think it doesn't necessarily address the issue of who's underemployed. So if we, you know, you can have a job, and this, I guess I'm a little sensitive to this because of my students right now, because they're thinking very deeply. I have a lot of seniors this year, and they're thinking deeply about where they're going to be placed in the spring or the summer. And it's, I've got, I think only a handful that already have been placed. So the rest of them are very focused on what they're going to be doing. And I think one of the bigger concerns is, are they going to be able to get a job in their chosen field? Or are they going to get a job that's tangential, that's not really what they want to do, and they're not going to be making the most use of their skills? And for a lot of my students, it's also a challenge of, what are my skills? So again, I think I'm a little more sensitive to this idea of, you could have a job, but it might not be truly the job for you or your career. And so you're, to some extent, underemployed relative to where you think you should be.
I want
to keep going, because how that speaks to employability. First of all, you see a whole lot of businesses that are now, they're not discounting degrees and academic credentials, but they're hiring based on skills. They're hiring based on, what you can do and to be able to show your work. So what I have my students doing in the first, the first course they take, the first IT, for the IT students, the first course they take, open a GitHub account and start storing all of your projects in there. Now, that could be the major project for a course, which might be all writing, but it would also be, programs you write. It would be things that, anything that you can document and store in there, because you want to be able to have a portfolio to show. You don't want to just go in and say, oh, yes, I think this is really important. You want to say, here's what I have done in this area, because companies are saying, what can you do for me, not what your credentials look like. So that's a big part of it. The other thing is that when we talk about the, and we talk about this in the academic world all the time, the critical competencies, that, you know, and what do they need? Is it creativity, collaboration, communication, critical thinking, entrepreneurism, global awareness, I'm reading from a list, technical proficiency, digital media literacy, and digital responsibility. That's just one list. We do exercises in class now that are built to address some of those. So, for instance, Tuesday, I got, you know, we got done with an exercise, and I said, what did we do? Because at the beginning of the class, we covered the critical competencies. What did you all just do? Well, let me see. You advanced the technical proficiency a little bit. You had to communicate because I made you report out to the class. So that helped with your communication skills. They were looking up, in this case, the exercise was to do a little research on different hardware, because what I did for the hardware section, this is an intro level course for IT, is I went back to things like the IBM 1401 from the 1950s and 60s and walked them, you know, by using devices as examples, walked them through the advancement of technology and how it unfolded. And so I said, you know, one of the questions was it a commercial success? The second question was, why was this important? And they had to think about that. And I said, see, what you're learning there is critical thinking. And if you don't tell them, they don't know they're doing it. But that's, you know, that's what's incumbent on us as instructors, is we have to make sure that the things that they need to be hired. So we go back to what you asked me original about people getting hired. The things they need to get hired and need to be successful is built into what we do. I can cover the material. That's not enough. The course objectives, not enough.
I it's interesting you bring that up. I'm notorious for giving vague assignments, and students hate it because, you know, they're not being hand-fed in what to do or how they're going to get an A. But my goal behind that is you have to think about what your boss really wants. And you have to take something, because you're going to be assigned work by your boss, and they're not going to tell you how to do it. And that's where the critical thinking comes in. What's the goal of the project? What is your boss looking for? What is the objective? And again, students really, really don't like me for it. But so many of them come away afterwards and have said to me, that was the best assignment I've ever had because I had to figure it out. I had to think about it. I had to figure out what the objectives were. I had to put together how I was going to do it. And again, it's a different skill set. It's a different way of thinking about things. And for a lot of students, it's one of the first times that they're ever tasked with doing something like that. But I love your suggestion of telling them afterwards, this is what you actually learned from it, because I've never done that. I think that'd be great.
It's a little different than what they used to do with us was lobby somebody's solution, and they would say, trace this out the next 20 years and see what it does to everybody.
Right.
That's kind of the same.
Once when I was teaching stats, and I hated teaching stats, and I haven't taught it since then. This was years ago. And we needed to do it because we needed to put it on the books because we had students that needed it to graduate. So I was teaching the stats class, and it had built into it a cumulative final. These are business students. They're not gonna give a poop about this. They're just not. You know, there will be things that they take away, and I tried to highlight what those are. And anybody who is going to get into operations and quality management is definitely going to need to understand statistics. However, they had a cumulative final built in there, and I thought, that's not going to prove anything. So I kicked it out.
What do you mean by a cumulative final?
It covered all. It was a 16-week course at the time. It covered all the material.
Ah, okay.
16. All
right.
So I kicked it out. And instead, I gave them a case. It was an interesting case because, if you buy coffee, there's a little plastic disc kind of embedded in the package. Mm-hmm. You ever noticed that little round circle, Tom?
I have.
Yep.
Yeah,
I have.
Yeah. That's a valve. It's there to let gas escape because as coffee beans ferment, they let off gas, and if you and if it doesn't work, then the bag puffs up and it could eventually explode. So I found a case about that. It was long. It had data sets. It had everything. It was about 14 to 15 pages long. And their assignment for the final exam was to read the case, understand the case, because it also had the solution built into it. And they said, now you have 2 pages. Explain it to your boss.
Well, there you go. I never thought of that. I'm so worried about my coffee exploding.
Well, you couldn't have explained it succinctly unless you understood it.
Right.
Unless you understood the application of the technology. And they were great. They did great with it. And, you know, again, that's the kind of thing, that's the kind of professional skills we need to put into our classes to make it work. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to teach a bunch of non-technical students about networks. And so they're going to do a little research about network components. And then they're going to take a company profile. We're actually going to develop a list of concerns. What do you care about, you know, with your network? Because if you have 4 distribution centers, you're going to care about downtime. That would be a problem if you can't pick, pack, and ship at your distribution center. They're going to care about data security. They're going to care about cost. They're going to care about how you support it. All of that kind of stuff. And so I said, okay, we have a good list. Now you're going to feed it into the AI engine of your choice, and you're going to feed in the company profile, say design the network. Their critical thinking part is they have to look at the result, which is going to come back in a minute or less, and they're going to have to look at it, and they're going to have to decide how well it addressed the list of concerns we developed. And
Larissa, when you guys said,
and then ask for clarification. This is the same thing that if I could have a bunch of network engineers in there, that they could do in person with network engineers.
Larissa, when you mentioned last time you were in, when they had the job fair down there, the people that were, let's say, civil, mechanical, and electrical engineers, were they able to, you know, if they had a decent grades and were decent, you know, looked halfway decent, were they able to go up and pretty much get hired in their field, or are those fields? I mean, when Bill was here before he died, I would say that the guys in civil engineering were in pretty good demand because there weren't very many of them. He said places were still hiring pretty much anybody that was pretty good. Was that your read this year, or is this year a down year, you think?
You know, I haven't seen a career fair yet this fall.
Really?
The career fair that I saw last year that included the engineers was hopping. And again, I think I told you that at that career fair, companies had to pay to get in. So I believe that it was a good career fair, meaning that a lot of the students were being hired. But I'm not in the engineering program, so I really don't have a whole lot of information besides what I visually saw at the career fair.
When Eric was talking last week, and I wanted your thoughts on this, actually the Bodie's thoughts on this, they say in the South Side. You know, Eric, he was retired, so when he was in school, he was probably a little older than us, Kevin. He said you went to school, it was inexpensive. You went to school to learn how to think. And you had a major, but you learned a kind of a bunch of stuff. You weren't locked in your major like you are now. If you go to Illinois and, you know, business, certainly if you go for agriculture, you can't even take a business course because they won't let you in, type of thing. So you learned to think. It wasn't that much, though. You didn't have any debt when you came out. And the object was whatever came at you afterward, you could handle it. You could research it. You knew where to find the stuff. You know, granted, there were people who wanted to be doctors and stuff, so it wasn't all like that. But as it got more and more expensive, it became more like a vocational school where you went for accounting because it would cost you so much. If you didn't come out of there with a degree in accounting and become an accountant for X number of money where you got to pay your debt off, it didn't work out. And he said, but now that's a problem. And Dr. Johnson was on like the day before. He says the people he's doing his psychology stuff for in New York, he's doing a lot of, he's retired, but he always does, helps people out. He's in New York, and all these guys have been laid off in the IT community. And he goes, and he had listened to Eric the day before, and he goes, it's exactly what Eric's talking about. These guys only know IT. There's no way they can drop back into and recreate themselves, because when they were in school, That's all they did. So we're getting kind of a pushback on the, you better learn something. You better get an engineering degree or a chemical degree or something where you can make some money, because look at what you just spent. He says, now it's coming around the other way, where all of a sudden your industry might not be there anymore, and you better learn to do something else. And guys are going, this is all I ever learned. So I know I was kind of rambling there, but what do you make of that? I mean, there's one sense that you better be a civil engineer, because those are the guys that are hiring at 150 grand a year, and you got a snowball's chance in hell of paying off your debt. And all of a sudden, I think we're always going to need civil engineers, but what if we didn't? Then what? I mean, that guy is having a tough time dropping into PTI and learning how to trade. I mean, he's certainly not going to go into business part of the place. I mean, have we become so focused? Now, what you teach seems like more general, where you're trying to get people to learn how to think. So you're kind of more the old model, if I could guess. But a lot of places aren't. I mean, they're just to learn IT, because that's where the money is now. What do you make of what I just said, if you could possibly sum it?
Well, for me to sum it, I would say we have to give them the skills. I can't not give them the IT skills, so that has to be a part of it. But, yeah, I do an accounting hit in my classes, just real basic level, because I say, you're going to have to know this. Because if you want to spend money in your career and you have some capital investments that you want to justify, here's how you do it. And if you don't speak CFO, you ain't getting approved, because your CFO's got to sign off on this. Much the same way, you have to be able to write for business, which is a very succinct style that is not the APA style that everybody wants you to use in college. You know, it's much more straightforward. But if you want, you know, there's kind of in the business world, there's two kind of readers of anything you write. There's skimmers, which is most people. They're going to skim your, you know, if you're writing a report or something like that, they're going to skim it for the part that is germane to that part of, you know, to each individual's responsibilities, and they're going to focus in on that. So you better make it easy to do that. And then part two of it is, there's nitpickers. And you know what? You write the same way for them. You don't overload it with a lot of prose, because the nitpickers will go after it. You use a lot of lists, bulleted lists, numbered lists, tables, things like that, always in favor of writing long paragraphs. And then you write short sentences to make it readable. I use active voice to make it readable. You know, I teach it, and that's what I'm pushing in throughout our IT department, is that this is what we have to teach our students if we want them to be successful. If we don't want someone with a software development degree who's going to go out and become a software tester and never advance, then okay, we'll teach them all about code, everything they need to know. They're going to get the entry-level job, and they're going to be stuck. But if we give them these other skills, they will stand out and they will be successful. And after they're successful, they'll be so grateful for the role that I played in it, that they'll be prepared to contribute to the GoFundMe for my nursing home.
Larissa, the stuff you teach, you're
in. Larissa, I got a text from a listener saying you're not coming through very loud. So either we have to rebalance Larissa's sound, or Larissa, you got to swing into full teacher voice.
No, I think I need to plug in a microphone.
Oh, okay.
Well, until you do that, what you teach? Are you part of the economics curriculum, or are you trying to round other people to provide a better education for people in other stuff, or both?
So I'm teaching in the business school, and I'm still teaching the College of Health and Human Sciences. And do I sound better?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, excellent. But I want to go back to Kevin's point. In my investments class, I spend, I would say, at least half the semester talking about investment theory, which is the framework for setting up things like the capital allocation capital allocation pricing model. It sets up the framework for how do we price assets. It sets up the framework for how the risk-free rate expands the economy. It sets up the theoretical framework. And the reason why, there's a couple reasons why this is very important, but one is it does set finance apart, that it's not a trade. So we have theory, and we're building it out, and we're teaching that theory, and we're teaching those critical thinking components in this aspect, because teaching somebody how to price a vanilla bond or a call option, that could almost be considered training as opposed to deeper thinking about what these instruments are and how do they play into the greater sphere of the world. And I do let my students know, you're most likely never going to apply the financial theory. Now, if you sit for a CFA exam, obviously you will have to be able to answer questions about this and be successful in completing the exam. And so I do let students know that, you know, here's, again, the academic framework for what we're doing and why we're doing it. Now, having said that, one of the things that I really like about the CFA curriculum, and I work hard to align my curriculum with the CFA, is there's something called a CFA research competition where this, and I've been helping oversee it for years. The students put together a sell side report, and it's 10 pages, and you're allowed to have 10 pages of appendices, and then it's a 10 minute presentation. And so, getting to Kevin's point, how do you quickly synthesize this information so that your recommendation of buy, sell, or hold is clearly seen in a way that really hits with potential investors? And this ability to communicate and to communicate effectively is so important. And this gets back to your point, Tom, what if there's no more civil engineers? Well, if a civil engineer has the ability for critical thinking, the ability for communication, the ability for learning how to read a room, they should, in theory, be able to migrate to another role, even if they don't have all of the technical skills, because they've been taught how to think. One of the reasons why engineers or undergrad engineering students are in such demand for graduate programs. So, for example, law school loves engineering students because they're taught how to think critically. They're taught how to approach a problem. They're taught logic. And as a result, engineers make fantastic lawyers. The CFA exam in finance, students, the number one area of, for people taking the exam outside of finance are engineers. And usually engineers are very successful in passing the CFA, again, because of their ability to think, logically work through problems, and solve problems.
All right, explain to everybody what the CFA is, because maybe some people don't know what that is.
The CFA is a Chartered Financial Analyst designation. It's a global designation that's recognized worldwide. There are three levels, and once you pass it, it demonstrates that you know a certain body of knowledge, and quite frankly, the body of knowledge is very large and covers many, many different subject areas, from portfolio management to derivative pricing, to quantitative methods, financial health, ethics, and economics. I think I might be missing one or two subjects for the level one, but it really demonstrates to, again, the rest of the world, a certain body of knowledge that you possess then.
Is that new? Because I never had one of those. I never heard one of those things.
Oh, no, it's been around since the 1950s.
Wow. I guess I should. Maybe I didn't think I could pass it. I never heard of it. That's wild. That's what I was, a financial analyst.
Well, I think particularly in the early 2000s, it really, I mean, even in the 90s, it became much more popular. Ah. But one of the things that's particularly for students, it's great about it, is if you're getting a master's degree in particular, and you're getting, let's say, a master's degree in Purdue versus IU, and you're an employer, you might not know the quality difference between Purdue and Indiana University. You do know what's going to be on the CFA exam. So if a student comes to you and they have this master's program that you're not familiar with, but they have a CFA, you know for sure what they know because they have successfully passed this exam.
I'm sitting there wondering how I do on this after all these years.
It's
tricky. I don't want to think.
No, and part of it, I think what might drag you down is the financial statement analysis. I think there's like 300 ratios that you have to have memorized. So some parts of it are a little more tricky. And the ethics, I struggled with the ethics. The ethics isn't necessarily what you would think morally is the correct thing. It's a combination of the what's right and also what's legal, but it's not quite compliance. So it's an interesting portion of the exam.
Wow, who puts all this together? It sounds interesting, actually.
There's a CFA society. And again, it's global. So this is a designation that's recognized around the world.
Are you in the society? Are you a big shot?
I am not in the society.
Well, how can we get you in?
I would have to pass the exam, and the recommendation for studying for level one is roughly 300 hours. And I don't have 300 hours with two small boys.
No, I don't think you have 5 hours with two small boys.
No.
Boys being boys. Well, that's sort of interesting. Here I thought I was an analyst, Kevin. I guess I wasn't, huh?
No, you're just a damn failure.
I'm obviously a failure along the line. You know, I used to know a lot of those ratios. I don't know if I know them anymore, but it's interesting that they involve options. I'm surprised at that. That's part of it. So option pricing models are part of that, eh? That's interesting. You know, the people in, boy, talking about a weirdo story, the people in Austria are really big on models. We went over there and we're doing some lecturing. And all of a sudden, we get in this bar. Imagine me in a bar. And all these guys are on me. And what do I like? This pricing model versus another one versus another. And I'm going, guys, they're all sort of the same, which isn't really true. But, I mean, if you start hanging on a pricing model, the variables themselves are more important than the model. I mean, these guys were really hung up on the mathematical side of things. This would be an interesting one for your students. They'd think I had about five heads, which they probably would anyway. One of the big weaknesses in the model is when interest rates get very high. I don't know if you knew that or not.
Yes.
You probably did, but do you think they do? Because when interest rates get very high, a lot of times your puts become an exercise early, and that screws up all your models. Because if you exercise the put into the short stack, all of a sudden you start getting interest when you don't on the put. And that's no model can handle that. I mean, but we haven't had interest rates that high in so long, and no have to. But who knows? We might get there again. The way we're treating the money supply, huh? Do you talk about any of that stuff? Any valuations? I guess I got to throw a little stocks and jacks at you here. What do you think of the valuations of some of these companies right now?
Oh, I'm very concerned about some of the valuations. I think some of the estimated growth rates going into those models are concerning.
Yeah, I don't really want to say that a particular stock is too high. I'll just say what the ratios are and kind of what they were in 2000 and the implied growth. Mm-hmm. When it starts to be 10 or 15 or 20 companies, and you look at the size of the companies and you go, only one of two things can happen. We're either going to have some real growth, or we're going to annex Mars or something and find out there's people up there, or somehow we're going to pour so much money into the system that it's going to be its own fruition. But I don't know if you watch this thing, in individual stocks, I don't usually talk about, but this Palantir the other day was up, was it Palantir? No, PANW was up. 25 was up like $70, and I think I got them at whatever it was. The stock's well over $300, and their revenue per share is now 13. We're not talking about income per share; we're talking revenue. So they're like 45 times revenue. I'm not going to say sell because who knows? They might be sitting on a gold mine that I don't know about. But when you start seeing stocks like that, I mean, even Microsoft, after the big run-up yesterday, is, you know, 12 and a half times revenue. I've never seen a company that size, that mature, have a revenue ratio like that. I mean, I'm not saying sell it, because it's probably going to go up more, but what do you make of stuff like that? I mean, I don't even, I mean, you look at a Micron. Well, Micron has revenue, but they don't have the same kind of margin. But some of the stuff, Nvidia, what's their stock's 231, and what's their revenue per share, like 12 or something, or 15, something like that. You got to look it up to make sure, but it's not very much, you know. And you just ask yourself, what is going on here? Are we becoming the Weimar Republic, where we're just going to keep pouring money in, and it's got to go somewhere, so that's where it goes? What if somebody asked you that question? What would you say?
Well, so because I actually talk about this in my class, and I have an example. I say, when my first was born, he weighed just over 6 pounds. Okay. And when, at the end of the year, you know, you do your annual checkup at the end of the year, he was 24 pounds. He grew 4 times in 1 year. I said, he will never grow 4 times in 1 year. You should never grow at that kind of rate ever again in your life, right? Could you imagine if you quadrupled your size? I said, there comes a point where you start to get big enough that even a 10% move is substantial. And this becomes very difficult to actually sustain. It's very popular, though, to put into your expectations, and management loves to, I mean, remember, I think it was, what, the 15 rule? We're going to grow our stock price at 15%. We're going to grow our EPS at 15%. We're going to grow our net income at 15%. And for a lot of firms, that's just not realistic. But the market ate it up. The market believed it. And the market priced it in as if the company was really going to grow at 15%. I don't see how that's possible.
Well, when you start to get a 15% growth in Microsoft is more than like 80 other companies.
Right.
I mean, it may not be 80, but it's, you catch, you know, you know what I'm talking about. I mean, the numbers become so big. What?
Well, and it's growth projections, but what's the plan? You know, is there a viable plan? You can, I can throw out any numbers I want. That's just a wild guess. So, you know, the question is, what's the plan? And, you know, Carl can jump in on this too, because he's someone who actually did start and grow a company. So he knows what it's like to have a plan and what it's like to execute a plan. And that's, you know, and it's usually not straight line growth. Sometimes things are going to work, sometimes they're not. So you're going to be, you know, you're going to be bumping back and forth on it.
Well, I think there's part of the problem that we see today, and this is the same sort of thing that happened in both 1998 and 1999 and in 1929. We all know how that movie ended. Is that when you post up numbers like this and you start talking about total addressable market, which is always an aspirational load of crap. Okay, there's never been a case anywhere in the market where anybody puts up something like that, and if it's for public consumption, it is actually based on reality. Okay, like ever. Now, when I originally did the business plan for MCS, we had approximately 7 million people in the metropolitan Chicago area. That was the area of service that we believed that we could reasonably reach without branching into other MSAs. Okay, so that's you know, that's what's known as Chicagoland. Fine, but I did not attempt to present to anyone, including myself, the lie that I could sell 7 million people on our services. That was absolutely ludicrous. First off, some of them are 6 months old. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of them are in nursing homes.
Some of them are like Larissa's newborn.
Some of them are in jail. Okay, I'm not going to sell a guy in jail internet service. Some of them are 80-year-old fuddy-duddies with a dial mechanical telephone on their wall still. All right, now that may not be true anymore, but it was at the time. Right, there were people that still had physical phone lines. In fact, at the time, Everybody had a physical phone line because we didn't have cell phones. Your internet service was over modems.
You actually had to remember a phone number. Imagine that.
You had to remember a phone. I mean, yeah, there was none of this nonsense that we have now. And while there were cellular phones, they were big bag phones that were these huge things. The first one that I had was one of those. So the problem now is that you look at some of these numbers that these companies are basing this stuff on, and the hype machine has to maintain this compounded growth rate or else all of it goes to hell immediately. All right, and everybody knows that, right?
Appear to know it. They're buying this stuff.
Well, everybody knows that the compounded growth rate, you know, if I put up 10% revenue growth this quarter, then I have to put up at least 10% revenue growth next quarter, right? I have to project that forward. If I don't project that forward, then my stock is going to get hammered. The problem is, as everyone also knows, however, that trees do not grow to the sky. All right, that there has never been a tree in the history of hominids crawling around this planet that has ever reached the moon. It has just never happened, and it can't happen.
Well, one of the things they have going for them, I don't know if you've ever mentioned this in class, Larissa. You probably don't, because I mean most people don't even think about it. They cheat. When I say they cheat, it's always a nasty word.
Of course they do.
Oh, NVIDIA just bought or is buying. What's the name of the place? Hopsing.
Hugging Face.
Yeah, Hugging Face. Next year, their revenue is going to be in NVIDIA's. They're not going to break that out. So it's going to look like NVIDIA. It's like Caterpillar bought, Bucyrus?
Yeah.
You don't see when they put the revenue out that here's Caterpillar, but, oh, by the way, here is Bucyrus. They're added together, so it looks like Bucyrus never existed, and Caterpillar actually did grow 40%, right?
Well, there's some of that that is part of where this comes from, okay, but not by any stretch of the imagination, all of it. My biggest problem with a lot of the kind of nonsense that we're seeing today is that you take for example this idea of so-called artificial intelligence, and now you just had OpenAI saying that oh my God, we've got this new model that is now coming out. It is essentially, this is better than humans, and da da da. The hype machine continues onward. Okay, here's the reality of it though, and I've been listening all hour. Okay, I've kept my mouth shut because I like to. There's times to interject and there's times to not. You cannot get around the reality of where the data is pointing you from the standpoint of the jobs numbers, from the standpoint of the other macroeconomic numbers. Okay, you cannot evade them. You can attempt to pretend they don't exist, and by God, are we doing a lot of that right now?
Oh yeah, well that's what we do.
Well, that's what markets tend to do, right? They always have done this. But the reality is what it is. And if there are two possibilities here when it comes to all of this machine intelligence and machine learning kind of nonsense, okay? And I'm going to illustrate this using a company that is in the news a bunch today, and that I just put an open letter up to our county commissioners and people like this, and that's this whole Flock Axon thing. Flock says that they delete the images that they take. It used to be 30 days, now it's 7 days. Okay, that's what they say.
All right, who's Flock? For everybody,
Flock is the guys that have the cameras on poles with solar panels that are popping up everywhere you look. Okay, go into a Lowe's parking lot, there's one pointing at their parking lot.
Lowe's, they got one in my parking lot here, for God's sake.
Yep, they're all over the place. Okay, now, what Flock says is that it reads license plates. and that this gives the police ways to track things, people that do criminal kinds of things. Okay. You know, who doesn't want to bust criminals that are actually committing crimes, right? I mean, that's, you know, let's pull on the heartstrings, and by God, you're going to be safer. All right. Here's the lie that comes from this. If you read their operating agreement, and they published this on their webpage, so this is not, I'm not digging into some proprietary thing that I had to go look for. It's right there for anyone who cares to look at it. Their proprietary data information is every piece of derivative work that they generate from their contractual operations with the people who buy their stuff. All right, what is a derivative work? Well, it's anything that's made from, right? That's the definition. So, what does this so-called artificial intelligent camera do? It takes a picture. That image is stored because a court is going to require that you actually produce the image if you try to charge somebody with something. Nobody's going to believe a computer that says, I saw this car with this license plate in this place at this time. If you actually try to bring a charge against somebody in a courtroom, you're going to get impeached instantly if you can't produce the actual picture of the car that was taken with a timestamp on it. All right, so they keep it around for that reason. If that image is flagged as part of an investigation, it gets kept because you have to be able to present it and experts have to be able to challenge it. That's the entire adversarial process in a court. That's fine. That's not why they put the cameras up. That's what they sold you. That's not actually what they're doing. They're taking the computer and they're distilling that this car that it saw was a 2015 Mazda 6 with a Tennessee license plate, blah, 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 blah. That's mine, by the way. Okay. Yeah. All right. And then, now, having reduced the image of the car to this piece of information, they then run a hash on it, which is exactly the same technology that's used to protect the password that you use to sign into your bank. And they store the hash. And that hash is stored forever. It is their property. Now, from the hash, you cannot determine that that was a 2015 Mazda 6 with license plate, blah, 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 blah. That's the nature of a hash. It's a one-way mathematical computation. So they're not lying when they say that they can't do that. They're telling the truth. However, if in the future a 2015 Mazda 6 with license plate, blah, 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 goes by one of their cameras and they run that same hash, they get the exact same value every single time. This is how your password works when you sign on to your bank again, okay? The entire internet's security model relies on this working, that there can never be a collision between these things. Can never be a collision. Otherwise, I can key in something random and it will validate as being you. And yet, you can't reverse it. Otherwise, it's the same thing's true on my form. The system knows you typed the same thing twice. It doesn't know what you typed. It just knows that whatever you put in the first time, you put in the second time. That's all it knows. But here's the problem with this. If I now know that I want a 2015 Mazda 6 with license plate, blah, 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 I can put that into their computer and it can produce a heat map every single place that that vehicle has ever been seen for all time.
Wouldn't that make you feel good, Larissa?
Now, see, they...
So now, every, see, here's every the time thing. You pull into the Purdue lot, they know where you are now.
Here's the
oh,
thing.
Oh, yeah, they do.
Oh, yes, but do. But see, here's the thing. They told you they deleted the pictures. They told you the truth about what they did. They lied about the intent of the system. They lied about everything about it.
They misrepresented.
No, it is a knowing misrepresented zentation. Chief, what is the common word for that in the law? When you knowingly deceive somebody for the purpose of pecuniary advantage.
I would say it's a lie, but what's the law term?
Fraud.
Oh, yeah. It's a...
All right, now, if you think that that's the only place this kind of thing is going on, all right, look at what just happened with Zuckerberg and Meta. They just settled a large lawsuit which, by the way, they were going to lose, that they their own people internally said that young people were the best ones to get hooked on their products because they were the most easily influenced.
Well, we all kind of know that, or should.
Well, duh, yeah. Right? Okay, now, they have maintained in public forever that they do not design their products and services in order to...
Carol, I saw the cigarette people walk into Congress and say there's no problem with cigarettes.
Boy, haven't you seen this movie before, right? With tobacco.
Well, let's say, I don't think Larissa's kids are old enough to be into this mess, but if they were 12 and 14, and Larissa's pissed off on because they spent too much time on Meta, and now there's this settlement. Does Larissa get a nickel for this or no?
Of course not. Because the states get all this money, but are you gonna get anything? Absolutely not. And oh, by the way,
sort of like the tariffs, huh?
Well, sort of like the tariffs, but it's even worse than that, because what we're really trying to do here is shape people's opinions and actions, okay? And oh, by the way, if you think this is just about trying to sell you another pair of Nikes, you got rocks in your head.
Well, hey, why don't we...
Okay.
Let's worry about this later. Why don't we talk... Yeah. While we have Larissa, let's dig into some of these numbers and what they mean that are coming
up. I want to point something out, Chief, because, you know, Hal's been all over this for a long time, and so has, you know, so have you and everybody else. You do realize that since Warsh has taken office, the Fed's expansion of its balance sheet has basically stopped.
Yeah, it's goes up and down. Yeah, it stopped.
But the growth rate has basically stopped. Now, the issue from a macroeconomic perspective is that what you have is the leverage associated with the price of securities, that there is a multiplier effect, just like there is if I pay for earnings. Let's say that I'm paying 20 times earnings for a particular stock. Okay, no company has 100% operating margin, right? So there's an implied, there's a deflator, if you will, in the price of securities that is a multiple of the expansion of the money supply.
It's not weird at all, and I'm looking at a piece of paper that I just did some calculations the other day, but I want to save them for half of these numbers. Listen, where I'm going with this, in case you're not still on, is the Fed's job, and I'm going to kind of be brief on what Carl's saying here. You look at the balance sheet, it gives you a clue what Warsh is doing, okay? But it's just a clue.
Right.
Because there are times when you manage the money supply. There are times when money supply, because we can grow it ourselves, when I say that our system allows, if Carl, you know, pulls money out from underneath his, and I don't think I'm telling you anything you don't know, Larissa, Carl pulls money off from under his bed and jams it in the bank, and you walk in and get a loan, and then put the loan back in the bank, you now, Carl just raised the money supply by, well, not really, because it was cash in circulation, but he puts it in the bank, maybe didn't even know he had it, but it's cash in circulation. He puts his 100 grand in there, you go borrow 80 and then put the 80 back in. The money supply is now 180 because you have a demand account of 80 and so does, and Carl has 100. So the two of yous just increased the money supply. Just as if you take a loan on your stock, buy some stock, and then flip the stock to the other guy and he puts it in his bank account. So right. The Fed has to manage this pool, as it were. And if it's growing on its own, and Warsh looks at the balance sheet and says, "Wow, look, boy, it's steady. I'm not doing this damage." It's his job at that point, if he's got a target on a money supply of say 1-3%, he needs to drop this thing dramatically just to maintain what he wants to do. He can't just sit there and say, "I'm doing nothing. Therefore, I'm okay." Because I've got these numbers in the 1 month. 5.3%, 2 month 5.3, 3 month, 8.1, 6 month, 7.1. Now, he wasn't there 6 months ago, but I'm saying those are not inflation fighting under any circumstances.
Right.
So, I mean, there are times when if you want to maintain a 2% growth and all of a sudden the economy is contracting, you got to start pouring money in just to maintain the 2%. So
Right, and the problem that we're running into right now, Chief, is that when you look at the internals of the employment situation, for those people who are Americans, they have been getting bent over the table since Trump took office. And oh, by the way, he wasn't the one that started doing this. It's been going on for a long time, all right? However, all of his rah, 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 bang, bang, bang on the table is a load of bullshit.
Well, yeah. Well.
If you look at the American-born, now this includes people who have birthright citizenship. They were born because that's American-born, okay? Whether you believe that they should have it or not is not the point. The point is that this includes those people, all right? If you take the BLS's own data...
Well, that would be my mom and dad, so I hope they were citizens. You know?
Well, it would count you. It might not count them, but if they were, if they were immigrants. All right. But it would certainly count you. So the point being this, if you take from the BLS's own data, the delta in employed, simply employed, leave the non-institutional population out, blah, 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 blah. And we know that number's going up, right? So the employed number has to go up. That's that 12-month run rate that I talk about every month, okay, which is, as far as I'm concerned, is the most important element of that report.
Right, hey, well, let's go to break for a minute before the number comes out. Larissa, can you hang in there until the number comes out and talk about it?
Sure.
Okay.
I'm here.
So we should get that in 2 minutes. Ricky, let's go for a real quick break and be back in time for us to come out.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks. Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.
Loading up Stocks and Jocks real quick because these numbers are all going to change in a second. We got the S&P futures up 2, NASDAQ futures up 149. They've been up pretty much most of the morning. We have oil. We give the oil number. Oil's down 83 cents, 90.45. And the key number here, boy, and the Japan stuff, is Japan, the yen went down to 155 yesterday as Japan said they're going to increase their interest rates, which they really don't want to do because they are deeper in debt than we are by like a factor of two. So there's 156 there. Do a quick one, Ricky, and then we'll be right back because these numbers will be out.
Good morning, Chief. It's currently 7:30 a.m. here in Chicago. We're looking at 74 degrees right now with a high of 93. Phoenix, Arizona, 85 degrees right now with a high of 103. Traffic in Chicago is 24 minutes. Emma Kennedy from Monroe's. Edens from Lake Cook is 38 minutes. We're looking at 36 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf. Dan Ryan from 95th is another 25 minutes. And Leslie Stevenson from 294 is 34 minutes. Yesterday, Sox lost to Astros 6-2 and Cubs beat Brewers 2-1. Today, we got Cubs at Marlins at 6:10 p.m., Twins at White Sox at 6:40 p.m., and Diamondbacks at Astros at 7:10 p.m. That's all I got for you, Chief. Back to you.
I'm showing the... What do you got? I've got the... On the household survey, we're up quite a bit.
I got... by the way, market no likey, you're down a little bit.
Yeah.
Why? Because the phantasm nonsense about Fed is going to cut rates, that just went up in smoke. By the way, the yield spike that I've got on that tens minus IRX, the reaction in that was instant and violent. So the establishment survey says plus 162.
It was supposed to be 50 or something, wasn't it?
Yep. 4.1, so that's an unch. Interesting thing. I've been talking about all of this H-1B and offshoring of entire departments, basically all those nice people who we, all those very nice young people that we conned into taking $100,000 worth of debt to go to college, then they get screwed and end up pulling coffees. Information industry lost jobs.
Well, Larissa, what do you make of these? If you're not aware of our dance, I talk about the household survey idiot page, and then Carl corrects me all the time with the real numbers. So
correct.
Got it. Well, he looks at the, I'm looking at the adjusted page that I'm going to guess that just about every professor would look at. It's the A1 number, and then these are adjusted. And then Carl digs into the unadjusted and tells me I'm wrong all the time. So we have our little dance going, which is fine, but. What do you make of
it? Go ahead and chat for a second while I pick these numbers up and give you the real number.
Yeah. Larissa, the numbers were, the ADP number came out terrible on Tuesday or Wednesday. And this number last month was a surprise to the downside. And now we're spiking back to the upside. And I don't know, I always have the idea. So last month we were down, what, 30? And this month we're up 160. So okay, in 1 month, every day, say it's a 20-day regular day month, every day 1,500 people get tossed out of work, and all of a sudden the calendar turns. And this month, every day 8,000 people get a job. I guess I find that hard to.
Well, you should because 320,000 people decided to couch surf last month. This is unadjusted, by the way. And the unadjusted...
The adjusted is 500,000 less people.
Trump's got his finger on the knob, right?
We're going to explain for what we're talking about. So the numbers we're dealing with, the couch surfers, there's, if you look at the amount of people that are not in jail, right, that leaves you 275 million people. According to this thing, and these numbers are probably somewhat accurate, 169 million of those, I don't know how often you guys go through this in class, are considered in working, meaning 162 actually have a job, and 7 million are actively looking for a job. Then there's 105, 6 million that we don't know what they're doing. They're retired, they're students. I mean, the kids in your class, they're in that column. If you're retired, you're in that column. Plus people who have stopped looking for work, that we don't count them as looking for work. But that's the other number to get you this employment percentage of people that are employed. So this month it seems like...
That would also include moms, right?
Yeah.
Stay-at-home mom.
Yes. Stay-at-home mom, yeah.
Yeah, so this is... So the employment population ratio is the single number that tells you whether or not fiscally... the government is going to be able to continue to do whatever it feels like doing, because it is essentially the difference between it is the percentage of the total adults who could be productive that actually are, okay, that are working in some capacity. And that number is currently stands at 59.1, which
doesn't horrible. Mean that everybody in the last column, you could be a gazillionaire retired and you're not taking a chunk out of anybody, so there's some of those people.
No, there's a lot of slop in there, but historically speaking, this number has been in the 64-65 area.
Wait, so I'd like to interject. So, like, Michael Jordan could be in that slop area.
Right.
No, well, today...
Today, yeah. Because
assuming that he's not quote-unquote working in some capacity. Now, if he's running his... Well, but which he is, he's running his LLCs or whatever have you.
Sure.
So he's working, okay, but this is the employment population ratio is the gross percentage of people who are contributing from a standpoint of the tax base, okay. That's the easiest way to think of it. Now the nasty part of this is that every tick in that number is approximately 600,000 jobs. So when you go from 64-65 to 59, oh God.
Yeah.
Okay. Because every single tick in that number is 600,000 jobs. Now from last month to this month it's stable. But from a year ago, it's down 5 ticks.
Yeah, if you want to sneak back and I don't think you've ever at least recently gone through it like this, Larissa, but if you go back to like 2000, for instance, you got 137 million people actually working, and you got 70 million people not working. So whatever that percentage is, it's a lot different than today when you have 162 million people working and almost 106 not working.
Yeah, well,
it's a big difference.
September of 2000, you had 136,790 employed and 71,014 not in labor force. The official unemployment rate was 3.9, which is not, that was actually down 2 ticks from 4.1, which was the previous month. And the employment population ratio was 64.2. Which was quite a drop. That was a 3-tick drop because this was, you know, right as things were starting to get nasty in the 2000 crash, right? So that actually was down from a 64.5 the previous month and 64.8 2 months prior. And so this was, you know, as things started to go down the toilet, so to speak, in the early 2000 time frame. But yeah, this is the interesting thing is that this. In the depths of the 08 blow-up and coming out of the 08 blow-up, you saw this number in the mid-58s.
Carl, sometimes, another stuff we look at all the time, Larissa, is when I was younger, if your nephew came and said to me, hey, Chief, I'm making $20 an hour, I would immediately go, okay, there's 2,020 hours in the year, he's making a little over $40,000.
Right,
you can't make that assumption today because everybody's
right. You can't do that anymore because of all the part time stuff.
All the part time, and then you don't want to keep somebody under what you have. So, Carl, you always dig into that piece of it. What was the one month where you had the amount of hours worked? Something went up, and the other thing went down. The hours worked actually went down, even the amount of people went up, or something along those lines.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of really kind of weird stuff in there, and that tends to be a pretty good indication as to what's going on in front of people being either hired or fired. And the reason is pretty obvious. I mean, if you think about it from a standpoint of a hiring manager, or as a CEO, or whatever have you, training people is I don't care what kind of skill set you come in with. There are job specific things you have to learn before you're productive. When you bring somebody on board, they're typically not. I mean, maybe they're somewhat productive, but they're nowhere near productive to their capacity the first day they hit the ground. Okay.
What do you mean? If you're from Harvard and you're in a law firm, you say sit down and don't say anything. You still charge $500 an hour for the guy being there.
That doesn't mean he's actually any good.
No, but yeah, who cares? As long as you can bill it.
Well, okay, but I mean, you know, when I started working for the first real job that I had out in the suburbs of Chicago, where drawing a nice W-2 paycheck, whatever have you, even though I was very highly skilled in field in programming Z80 microcomputers, which was what they hired me to do, I had to learn. How are all the source code that we're working on? Where is it all laid out? How's this? The people who came before me, how did they structure the data sets that that this software has to work with? Blah 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 blah. It takes me time to get that, even though I'm very good at what I know how to do, and so you don't want to be instantly responsive if you don't have to. So the first thing that happens is in expansions is that hours tend to expand because and that pressure eventually forces you to hire because overtime is expensive. And therefore, if you're actually going to have that demand on a continual basis and you're pretty sure that that's going to be the case, you're going to prefer to bring on additional people over time. Likewise, when things are going down the toilet.
So what are the numbers here today showing you? And are there any? Last month they had the 100,000 hour reductions for the last few months. Is that today or no?
Well, this is interesting. The biggest drop in aggregate weekly payrolls in terms of percent change, and this is just in the last month, is in information, and it's -0.9. Now that is a
which ties in. It's Larissa, it's funny. I mean, and I do this every day. I have people of all different skill sets, obviously. And it's amazing how it ties together. I mean, what Carl just said, I'm not surprised, because Dr. Johnson, who was on a week ago Wednesday, said he's in New York consulting with all kinds of people getting laid off that have IT jobs.
Well, here's the interesting thing, though. The average hours in information is up a tick. So what we're seeing here is that people are getting fired, and their work is getting transferred onto others.
Well, I hear, on the same note, I'm a...
I wanted to listen to a comment on this, but I heard it yesterday. It's the other way around.
You know, the CBOE fired like 25% of the people. Now I understand they're in a panic to hire half of them back.
Well, okay, this is happening a lot, Chief. This is starting to show up in a bunch of places. Now, this is anecdotal because I don't have a survey, right, that I can point at. But the anecdotal stuff that I'm hearing is that of basically everybody, all these companies, they all went down this AI road. AI is going to save us, blah, 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 blah. They turned around and they canned a bunch of people, believing that they were going to be able to replace them with the computer. Okay, which, I mean, if you're right, that works out pretty well, right? Well, it hasn't worked out. And that's an extremely serious problem now, because they turned around and they fired these guys, and then they found out that the productivity actually went down as opposed to going up. And oops, right? So now all of a sudden we've got a really, really big problem in that you've got all these folks out here that, you know, they dumped them in the can. And oops, we now have an issue in that the work's not able to get done across our workforce. And now we got, let's go hire them back. Yeah. Well, listen, let me tell you something. If you do something like that to me, guess what's going to happen to what I'm going to tell you? You're going to have to pay me.
Yeah, let's. All right, Larissa, you've heard our jousting around. I hope you learned something, the way we tear this apart. What's your opinion?
No, I think it was great. But I must bid adieu. Thank you so much for having me on this week. I wish everybody a wonderful, wonderful Labor Day weekend. I
hope we didn't chase you away with all these labor numbers.
Yeah, you know.
Well, she did drop off. She did. She has to go drop the kids off.
She's gone. So here's the other thing. You know, I've talked about this bifurcation on the diploma thing too, right? August is typically a month in which you see bachelor's people start to show up in the workforce. Okay, college grads. Why? Because, well, you're a month behind, right? I mean, this is...
Yep.
That's the way it works. And indeed, that, in fact, did happen this year. So this is... That's good. That's what you want to see, is there's, you know, that boost is there. The other problem, though... And by the way, the same sort of thing you would think would be on the other side, but it's not. The high school grad people, the loss there is substantial, and you're not getting anywhere from if you have an associate's or you have some college. So, and that bachelor's degree hiring is almost certainly just people coming out of the collegiate experience on the back end of the snake, so to speak. And that now, you know, which we'll see if it continues into September. It's just August is a month. Sometimes it's in July, but it wasn't last month. But it almost always shows up either in July or August for new grads. And this year it showed up in the August report. So that's to be expected. But yeah, the weekly hours is kind of interesting. I think that's something that. Looking at the data, I'm like, this is punky in the information area, and that's a problem, Chief, because those are very well paying jobs.
I don't know, but Dr. Blade introduced stuff about the inflation. He said, all of a sudden, if you lose your job and your apartment rent is $10,000, I don't care who you are, you got about 3 months.
Yeah, you're screwed, right?
Yeah, you're not living with mom, and 6 months later you can still be okay. It's not that's not the drill. If you move somewhere and you got an apartment and all that,
Right. Here's the other thing in information, and this is something that I don't like this number at all. While the average hourly earnings are up some. Oh, by the way, well, actually, wait a minute. No, I'm wrong about that. Information average hour. Ooh. Ow. All right. So these are people that are making 50 on average. You know, the medians, whatever. You know, it's actually average. It's not median. Average hourly earnings, 55.53 an hour. That's, I mean, that's good money, right? I mean, yeah. These are all people making over 100 a year, right?
Assuming they're getting the full hours, yeah.
Well, okay. Here's the problem. Last month they were making 55.70. Now they're making 55.53, and their check is down.
Yep.
All right. Now, for those people who, and this again, this kind of dislocation, when this sort of thing comes in an industry that is in the high-paying area, you got problems. This is not going away anytime soon, and this is a very serious thing that's in the inside of the jobs market, and it goes directly to this issue with offshoring labor and bringing in H1s and H4 EADs, and this stuff has to be stopped. It I don't know how we're going to stop it.
I know a lot of people have the sort of are into this thing that everything's wrong with us is because other people are here. I'm not there, but you know what?
Chief, it's not because they're not there.
I'm trying to agree with you here for a second. Give me a chance.
Okay.
I'm not near as concerned as you are about the guys hanging in the Home Depot parking lot. This stuff you talk about, this high-end stuff, I'm appalled by that, actually. Maybe
well,
even,
they're
maybe
only,
even
the
more
only
than you are.
The reason they're being brought in is because they're cheaper. It has nothing to do with the quality.
That's what I'm saying. The idea of you know, some guy cleaning out your basement for $50. I don't know. You know, I understand it's probably a little bit of an issue, but it's not something that's going to. It's that's kind of always happened. It was young kids used to do it, but the idea of somebody coming in here and not being able to go, if somebody brought somebody in, it's $75,000 and the going rate was 100. If he could walk down the block and get 100 somewhere else, I'm not as worried about it. But the idea that it's somewhat of a slave labor thing, I'm real concerned about it.
Well, it is, and the other problem with this is that it's worse than you can imagine, Chief, because not only is there a nepotism element to this, okay, which is very serious, but there's an even bigger problem in that we are finding, when investigations are actually done, that in many cases there's a formal kickback system.
It wouldn't surprise me.
All right. So these guys are being brought into the country, but in order to get hired, they're having to kick back part of their pay to their hiring
No,
managers.
No kidding.
Yeah. And so, I mean, you want
to
talk about...
I ran into that when I tried to get a job on the Dan Ryan 50 years ago.
I'm saying, you want to talk about something that is ridiculously corrupt.
None of this is new. It's been... Hey,
well, I understand it's not new, Chief. Yeah. I'm just saying...
I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying that they didn't invent that trick.
Well, no, they didn't. Right. You're absolutely right.
Hey, I want to lob something out at you. You're my confessor here. I'm getting a little, I'm going to say, very worried about what's going on, more so than maybe I should, only because my background, even though I probably couldn't pass one of these CFA tests because I didn't know what they were, that's what I was, Carl. I was an analyst. And
right.
And I was a pretty damn good one, even though I couldn't have passed the test probably. The thing that always got me is whenever somebody gave me a project, being, you know, building a railroad car, whatever it is,
right.
Or I did something from the SIBO since they didn't have an analyst, and I was on the board, and I said, I'll tell you what, I'll do the work for you. Don't tell anybody I did it. They wanted to buy this building. We were gonna the CBOE was gonna get together with the Pacific Stock Exchange, and they were gonna build this big building. And they were gonna take the bottom few floors, and the rest of it was gonna be. And there was all these plans. You know, it's gonna take this much to. But every time I did one of these, and I probably did you know, five or six big ones with rail car manufacturing stuff. It struck me, I'd always do the sensitivity analysis, which, you know, I don't, people don't even know what that is. Everybody tells you what's going to happen and everything's going to work out right, okay? Well, then, of course, things never work out right. So you take a jab at it. You say, all right, the leading product that you need, the wheels and axles aren't going to be here. They're a month late. Or the price of labor is going to go up. Or something. There's a hurricane. Whatever the hell it is, you think of like 8 or 10 different things that could impact the project, and you jab them in there. And if you, I found over a lot of these, I mean, not a thousand of them, that if you priced it right with a little bit of, with some, you know, some, I won't say fluff in there, but something that, I know our labor rate's going to be 90% efficient, but by the way, if it's 85, we'll still, you know, we'll still be okay.
Yeah, we're still fine, right.
So I found that you could take any one of the variables, or maybe every two of the variables, and you could really get it a punch. Generally, the project was still okay. But if you took five or six of them and took a little bit off them, it was way worse than any individual one that you just, you know, eviscerated. And so it was like the projects become like the death of a thousand cuts. And I'm looking at what's going on with our economy here, and the money and the stock market's part of it, because that's what I do for people. You need all these little things I'm reading and seeing, and you know, this is not right or left. This is just the stuff I pick up on. I see that Japan raising their interest rate to jam this thing down. Well, of course, I look and see Japan had their public debt. Our public debt is now over our GDP, which is pretty awful. Theirs is 2.5 times their GDP.
Right.
So now all this interest rate, if they raise their interest up, how exactly are they going to pay for that? And oh, by the way, we owe them $1.1 trillion. So we're banking on these guys taking care of our spending habits here to a certain extent. And oh, by the way, Trump is pissed off at Britain, so he's gonna give the Falklands if he can to Argentina. By the way, we owe those guys, UK, $970 billion. Now this morning I read Norway, they got the biggest sovereign wealth fund in the world. They're going to cut way back on their investments in the U.S. Now, they're not huge. They're $300 billion or something, but $250 billion. But I see all these little things starting to happen, Carol, and I see, you know, the budget every month, it's the deficit's bigger than they think. I mean, all this little crap is starting to it's starting to sound to me like when I used to do these analysis for projects. And we're getting nipped at every little spot. And so every single time somebody opens their mouth saying how good things are, I see like 15 different arrows kind of pointed at us here. And I'm just wondering, if they all meet in the middle someday, I don't know what we're going to do. Because I don't see any way out of this, do you?
Well, that's certainly one of the problems. And I think it's an extremely...
Is my analysis that wrong?
No, it's not. And I am very unhappy about a lot of the things that are going on right now from a standpoint of how all of this is being, you know, put together, so to speak. I don't see, Chief, where is anybody paying attention to any of this from a standpoint of the conglomeration of the fact that we have, you know, we have Vance saying, well, you know, they really need to cut rate. We, you know, same thing Trump's been saying, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Excuse me, we're running a 6% fiscal deficit.
Yeah.
All right. The entire problem from a standpoint of that 6% fiscal deficit, the whole thing is in CMS. It's up over, and now we don't, you know, in the next, we'll find out when the next Treasury statement comes out. CMS spend over the last comparable.
Well, we're not helping it with a war, you know.
You can swat at mosquitoes, but the swarm of yellow jackets is where the problem.
Well,
is.
You're not going to get. Right? We debate this. We're not debating. We agree on this constantly.
But here is the point. It's up 13.4.
Well, okay, but where I'm trying to stay a little global on this, and I know that's the spot we got to go. I get that part, but what I don't quite understand is we're trying with all our basically our bullshit, We're trying to talk the population into lending them money at 3% or 4 or 5.
Well, you're getting raped with a 6.
When we know the inflation rate, if they keep doing this, the inflation rate 2 years from now is not going to be 5. It's going to be 10 or 11 right. or 12. And we're essentially raping our population by saying, you idiots, give us money at 3. And by the way, the inflation's going to be 9. Ha, 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 and you. I mean, somewhere along the line, people are going to figure this out. And I think maybe they sort of are right about now. And I think you might agree with me on that.
Yeah, I think they are starting to figure it out. And then on top of that, at the same time that we're doing this, in order to maintain the market bubble, which is enormous.
Well,
okay,
I'm just going to say that right now, as long as the market keeps going up, everybody thinks everything's okay. If you got a 401k, if you're in the 1% of group, or a lot of people, I mean, it's a whole bunch of people own stock. I mean,
unless you're the guy who just lost his job.
Yeah.
And oh, by the way, you were making $100,000 a year in Cincinnati, and they just moved the entire department. And the reason the stock went up is because took 20% off their operating expense.
Firing people. So how exactly, what happens? I mean, now, you know, we're bigger than Japan. We're not, you know, what happens if those guys have to start paying 7%? How do they stay afloat?
Well, that's a problem, right? I mean, you know, isn't it interesting that Kroger, you know,
by the way, they sold in from the last numbers we have is May to June. They sold $27 billion in U.S. Treasuries to pay for what they were doing. Now, I have to believe that when the July numbers come out, they're down again.
But
we need that money, right? Every month you talk about the Treasury.
Really?
Yeah, really?
Well, I mean, take a look at this, though. You know, Kroger comes out with this thing that they're moving this entire department over to India, right? 5,000 well-paid employees out of Cincinnati, all right? And yet, if you look at their chart, from March, they touched $75 and change, okay? And right now, they're trading at 58. So very clearly, what this is about is attempting to get the market to give them a better multiple on simply because they cut their operating expense and employment, right?
Well, if you had to guess, with your knowledge of the industry, if we're still doing the show 10 years from now, we're both still healthy, and we were to send, you know, our smartest, hopefully by that time we'll have a guy who does have to work for us, if we were to send our smartest guy and say, you go take a month, or we'll hire Larissa and her gang from Purdue, give us a month analysis, was this actually worth it for Kroger? What do you think at the end of the day that's going to show?
I don't know, but my experience with people coming from the Indian nation goes back an awfully long time, because I used to do contract work before I ran my own shop, and you know, I've dealt with this, okay? I've also dealt with some of the nepotism and some of the, you know, hey, we got to have diversity, and so we hire this person. People that literally couldn't program their way out of a paper bag. I've dealt with that in corporate America. And it is sometimes it's a pure money thing. Sometimes it's a social engineering kind of thing, because we got to check a box here or there, whatever have you. I've never seen anything other than hiring on pure merit work out, ever, in terms of actual productivity and output. It has never been, it's never paid off, but it always, in terms of productivity. Now, where it does pay off, however, in the world of public companies today, is in the same place where it pays off when people use the word AI. They immediately, you know, you look at what Salesforce just did, okay? The company has been getting drubbed for months, because everybody's saying, oh, you know, this software as a service thing is going away. Then they turn around and they announce an AI partnership, and the stock skyrockets.
Well, it's like saying you had a .com back in 2000.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly the same thing, all right? I mean, here is, you know, the firm that he has, you know, they're trading in the right around $200 for quite some time. And all of a sudden, now they're up near 270.
I'm asking one very insightful question, then we got a dash, having to do with the Kroger situation, because I did a little bit of designing of corporate compensation packages. You know,
well, I know those guys fairly well because I've worked with them in a former role, but that was, I mean, you know, it was 25, 30 years ago.
Right, so, I mean, but if there were no stock bonuses,
right,
stock options, and there was no anything like that for the president or people on the board, or not that there shouldn't be, but if you put him on a different compensation package, let's say the 20-year plan, where he's judged how well the company does over the next 20 years and not over the 6 months or year, do you think he would have done it?
Yes, if he can, if the cost shifting and the game playing with regards to both the immigration side, the offshoring of labor, and the offshoring of supply chains is not just a next 3 month quarterly report thing. It's the reason that I have said all of this time that you have to have wage and environmental parity tariffs that in some form or fashion, because you can always find people that have a crappy standard of living in a crappy country that can do some part of your job, but their cost of living is so much lower.
Well, we'll tie into it on two of them. If you're the electric company, and I can't go anywhere else, and I'm
the electric company is a different
situation.
That's what
I'm saying, you know,
right.
This could, let's talk about it on Tuesday, because I mean, is it going to work out for them? I mean, it'd be really even worse if they laid everybody off and it did work out for them. And then they went under, I mean, or whatever. I mean, that'd be the double whack, right?
I think that, well, yes, and this is part of the problem, is that when you destroy the merit-based, I mean, you know, and I know there's, you know, whether or not that's real or not is somewhat of a chimera, right? But if you destroy that completely within a corporation, it's a matter of time before somebody eats you. And it's going to happen. I don't know when it'll happen. I don't know how long it'll take, but it inevitably is going to happen, and that's bad.
Well, S&P futures were up a bunch. Now they're down 18. Nasdaq futures up a real lot. They're up almost 200. Now they're only up 11, but they still are up.
Yeah, it's basically pretty close to unch.
Well, everybody have a nice weekend. It was 84 when I pulled out of the. This is Chicago in September, for God's sake.
This is Chief. This too shall pass. We're going to get somewhat of a break from it here after the weekend.
So
thank
are we,
God,
because so
this is ridiculous. Yeah.
All right, bud. You take care of yourself. Everybody have a nice Labor Day. Safe Labor Day. And we'll be back on Tuesday. Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.